Welcome to Development as a Service, a show for freelancers, contractors, and employees making a living as developers.
We're here to share some stories, tools, and ideas that are helping us navigate the twists and turns of working in the service industry.
We're your hosts. I'm Carter Bryden.
And I'm James Doyle. So we made a general list of five things that we think are difficult or can cause us pain on a daily, weekly, monthly basis. And I guess our goal here is to see, we don't know what each other wrote down, but I think it'd be cool to walk through each one. I'll name my five, then you'll name your five, and we'll see if there's any crossover.
Sounds
good.
See
what we have. And then we'll go through each one. So we'll talk about 10 items, and some of them may overlap.
Yep. Oh, I'm guessing there's going to be a few.
You think there's going to be a few?
Oh,
I think
yeah,
I copped
sure.
out on a couple of them.
Yeah?
Yeah, right. I think so, but we'll see. Do you want to go first?
Okay. So my first one is estimating. And so just across the board, estimating how much effort something's going to take.
Right.
Estimating timelines, what resources things might need. And then even going into things like requirements. So
right.
The thing with estimating anything as a developer is that when you're making the estimation is when you have the least amount of information about that thing.
Yeah.
So at the beginning of a project, you might think you have the requirements, but you don't necessarily. Mm-hmm. You think you know how long something is going to take, but something always comes up.
Yeah.
It's basically that whole, the old saying of no plan survives contact with the enemy. Well, no project survives the estimate.
Nice.
Yeah.
I have a similar saying. I say to our team, like, we'll never know more about the project until we're at the end.
Mm-hmm.
That's when we'll know the most. When we need to know the most is at the beginning when we know the least.
So let's just set the price at the end. We'll just figure it out later.
Yeah, everyone loves getting a bill at the end of the project without knowing how much or how long it will take.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was, you said estimates, right?
Yeah. So just estimating in general, it's funny because that was the first thing that came to mind, and maybe it's because I've been doing some estimating lately, but that's something you're doing pretty much every day, even if you're not working on a brand new project, you're not scoping anything out,
mm-hmm.
you have to estimate, can I get this done before lunch? Do I have time to do this before my next meeting? Am I going to get interrupted in the middle of like something complicated?
Yeah.
So yeah, that's easily one of the most frustrating. And I think any business would argue that that's the thing that we're also the worst at as developers, just in collectively in general.
It's funny because, like, yeah, I think one of the things around that is like, oh, yesterday it took you like an hour to like add this feature. But like, how come it takes you like 5 hours to add this same feature with like a slight twist?
Yeah.
I think that leads, I have an example of estimates with my first item on the list. My list.
All right, let's hear it.
All right, so the first thing I put was forms.
Forms.
Dealing with forms.
Oh, I didn't get that literal with it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Forms. Like, yeah, I have some specific things. I have some vague things. So this is probably the most specific thing on my list is forms. So dealing with forms. So speaking of estimates, I had a project which was like, client wants to add a contact form to their site.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, cool. So they're like, yeah, so just a generic contact form, like, you know, the basic thing. We didn't necessarily name out the fields, but I'm like, cool, I'm going to put name, email, message. And that was basically it. And they're like, oh, but they want like a PDF for like attaching like resumes.
Yeah.
Like if someone has a resume they want to attach, I'm like, well, double the budget, like double the hourly budget. Cause like we don't have any file uploads supported in this particular project. So I went from adding like three fields to adding a whole file upload like flow in my code to be like, hey, is there files? Handle the files. Is the file too big? Is the file too small? What type of file is it? What if the file fails during, like, what if it fails to write? What if it fails to write to the disk? What if I, like, how do I attach it to the email? Like, all this stuff from just like one field added like twice as much work.
Well, and why? I mean, again, why would someone technical not know, or why would they know about the difference between going from something that essentially boils down to text, like every other form field essentially will boil down to text, a number, or Boolean, I guess.
Yeah.
So, but the difference between that and a file and the things that you have to do to handle that, like, you might as well, like, that's two separate applications almost in the way that you have to think about how you're handling things.
Well, I mean, not just the file, but like, okay, well, our max size for post requests is 2 megs.
Yeah.
So now I have to tweak the server.
Yeah.
Cause like its post max size is 2 megs, or like the Mac, the timeout is like 3 or 4 seconds for a post request. So, okay, well, I got to go and edit all that stuff on the server. Has nothing to do with how the form is made, what it looks like, how it functions on the website. But like, mm-hmm. it just will not work until I make changes to our server that the site is actually running on.
Yeah.
So this weird thing that's like, oh, we want a form here on this part of the front end of the website. I have to SSH into the machine, or like write a script to upgrade the box to like tweak the settings. Like,
or
oh,
talk
my
to
God.
The DevOps guys.
Yeah, totally. And another thing is like, okay, well, have you ever tried to style a form input to like make it custom?
I have strong feelings on this.
Oh my God.
For two reasons. One, I would like nothing better than just style every form input exactly how I want. And the other half of me is going, well, iPhone users want their inputs to look one way, and Android mm-hmm. users are used to a different way.
Yeah.
And people in Edge
yeah.
know what a form input looks like. So if you start styling it, you're messing with them. You're not improving their experience.
Yeah.
But
they look
it
terrible.
Goes both ways. It's terrible. A two-way street. It's a that one's
my and then so tough. Another part of forms, like my sub complaint is mm-hmm. drop downs. So like mm-hmm. you probably looked at a design where it's like, oh, there's a custom drop down, and you're like, oh no, because like designing custom drop downs, although they're great usually on desktop, as soon as you jump to mobile, it's like now you're yeah. now, like you said, you're fighting with their native experience.
Yep.
Like now I can't use my nice Android like big list to pick. I can't use my little iOS like Rolodex to pick. Yeah. I have to like navigate through your crappy implementation of a drop down that looks a little nicer but works way worse.
Or you need to double up on the implementation. What works right. on desktop a lot of the time is a terrible choice when it comes to inputs mm-hmm. for mobile.
Yeah,
I mean, if you've got something that, for instance, is a dropdown that has sub options, you know, so you've got option groups, for mm-hmm. instance, that can be a really terrible experience on mobile.
Yeah, totally. Or like there yeah. have like even those dropdowns that are like multi-select.
Yeah.
And like, how do you implement a proper multi-select? I usually end up using a checkbox to yeah. do it, to like make a custom multi-select drop-down, quote unquote.
Yep.
Or like, what about the ones where you can like type and it filters the results, and like you pick it, but like now you have a whole bunch mm-hmm. of different events you need to listen for. That's not clicks. They're like touch starts or touch ends or yep. touch moves or whatever you might be listening for. So like all that noise,
I guess,
on top of styling is like, oh my God, yeah. it's so difficult to like get these things to work.
It's pretty brutal. And I guess you could honestly say that like, a lot of what is going on with front-end web development is basically expanding and working around forms yeah. anyways. Like a website is just a really complicated form, or a web app is.
Yeah.
Is just a really complicated set of forms yeah. for the most part.
Yeah.
A lot like, of do what this it's
thing.
Doing is...
Enter this yeah. data. Send this person this thing.
Yeah.
Describe this thing. Write this thing down and export as text. Like whatever it might be.
Yeah.
Like Slack is like a bunch of forms.
Yeah.
Like you Slack can drop files into it. You can paste into the field. You can exactly. like add attachments. You can like post new things. Like how many forms are there in that mm-hmm. thing?
Which is kind of funny in that we have what seems like a lot of different field options for forms, but when it comes down to what you actually need in reality and, mm-hmm. and to practically make something that people expect these days,
yeah.
it doesn't even come close.
Yeah. You know? And people make their own like custom. Like, remember when range sliders weren't supported in all browsers?
Yeah.
And, like, you couldn't use a range.
Are they supported in them all now?
I think older Firefox still doesn't support range input.
Hmm.
But, like, or think about, like, date inputs. Like,
yeah.
Oh, my God.
Date
like
inputs
how many,
still don't work
they, yeah,
standardized
they still
across
don't
the
work
board.
Across all browsers. So, you have, like, and also you have date time formats, too. Mm-hmm. So, it's like, I want this European format.
Yeah.
But like, oh, I want this Canadian format. I want this American format. I want this other format.
Why can't everybody just agree that it should be year, month, day? Then everything.
You like year, month, day?
Year, month, day is what works when you, with sorting, with filtering, it works across the board with everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's the easiest to understand, largest to smallest, and almost nobody uses it.
Great. I can't wait to not use it in my next form.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So what's next on your list?
So I guess this actually kind of relates to that a little bit, which my next point is just the wide range of knowledge that you have to have as a developer in general, and the fact that it changes constantly. So the first thing is that the range of knowledge is vast, to put it simply. If you start web development today, if you're a complete junior to this, like, where do you even start? Do you start with JavaScript? That's probably where I would recommend someone in web development start, because you're going to use it at some point. Yeah. But okay, so let's say, okay, great, you're going to start with JavaScript. No. Now what? Do you learn plain JavaScript? Maybe. Do you learn React? Maybe. Mm-hmm. What do you learn? But even outside of that, you can go right into working with a team, working with clients if you're doing things like freelancing. Mm-hmm. You have to be a jack of all trades no matter what. Right. When all of the wide range of things really would work better if you were a specialist, like almost always, but it's pretty much impossible to get anywhere as a specialist, at least right off the bat. You're going to have to spend a while being a generalist to get anywhere for the most part.
To find your specialty?
Yeah.
Yeah, I can definitely see where it's like the junior people do the most varied work.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I guess you don't see that with other professions, at least ones that require... Like how many lawyers are like, oh, I'm a jack of all trades lawyer.
It's yeah.
Like, there are some, but like there are mostly specialized, or like how many doctors are like, yeah, I'm a general practitioner. Like that's a thing, but it's like, it's also its own kind of specialty.
Yeah. Being general is a specialty,
which is like weird to think about, but it's like, also there's a guy who does, or there's a guy who just does shoulder surgery. There's a lady who just does hand surgery. Like they work on body parts down to like the segment of the body, but then you have the generalist, and that's a specialty as well, which like here it's kind of like we kind of silo people, but then we have weird things like full stack developer, which is like, so how many specialties is that?
Well, and what is a full stack developer these days?
Yeah, like where does it start?
I call myself a full stack developer, but if someone asked me to define it, I'm probably using the definition from like 5 or 10 years ago, which is I can handle the front end, I can handle the back end, and I can set up a server.
Yeah.
But what does that even mean anymore? Okay, what front-end frameworks do you know? Like, oh, I know these things. Well, do you know how to do this in that framework? Well, no, I'm not an expert at that framework. Yeah. Well, how can you call yourself a full-stack developer then?
Right.
So I think it's
ever-sliding scale to, like, meet.
It's a bit of a double-edged sword in that there's so much out there available knowledge wise too. Like, you can, the learning resources are insane in this field, better than any other field I've ever heard of. Like, you can't just go out and get a law degree very easily. You can't go out and get the knowledge you'd need to be an actual doctor without going to university. But here I would argue that the resources available just online, just things you could Google, are better than what you could get in a university if you could curate them. If you had all the best stuff, it would be better than most university programs, I bet. But well,
I think a big sort of like testament to that is like, how many people do you know that have like computer science degrees? Like, there's a few. Like you said, I think you've said you didn't finish yours.
No.
It's like, so you were getting paid to do this already.
Yeah.
What's the point in going to school to get paid if you're being paid already for the thing you're going to school for?
Well, and
I had a similar situation.
Yeah, because you've done two different programs, right?
Yeah, I had I did an audio engineering program, and then I did this development. It was called multimedia design and production.
Right.
So it was web and design and a bunch of other stuff.
Yeah, and so I found that the longer I do this, the more value I find in some of the classes I took in university, where originally I remember thinking, this is stupid. This is not practical.
Yeah.
The only time I'm going to use this is if I go into academia.
Yeah.
And some of that has really carried over. Some of it still hasn't. Maybe it will in another 5 or 10 years. But it's definitely, I could have easily gotten by without that. Like, the things that I got out of university did not lead to my success in my career.
You got different things out of it, right?
Yeah. I mean, not knowledge necessarily. Yeah, I got value out of it, but that value, my career would be in the same place with or without it. I'm absolutely certain of that because, for one thing, I've never had anyone ask me about my schooling, ever. I've never had anyone ask about my education.
And they're like, where did you go to school? Like
this, never professionally. This right now might be the first time I've talked about this in maybe a year or two outside of maybe conversations you and I have had.
Yeah.
But nobody cares. They care if you can do the thing. Yeah. But again, wide range of knowledge. Everything's changing constantly. So, I mean, the JavaScript world is the easiest example of this where, and partly because you're forced to use JavaScript. Client-side in the browser. Like, you don't have any other options until assembly,
WebAssembly comes.
WebAssembly becomes a more of a thing, which I'm really interested to see how that affects things. But still, right now and probably for the near future...
It'll probably be a couple... I would say realistically, like, at least 1 or 2 years before we can finally use it, like, confidently.
Yeah, before it's mainstream by any means, I would say. But just the fact that it changes so quickly, you can't learn something once like a lot of industries and professionals do. You have to keep learning the new thing or even the same thing, but now we do it this way.
Right.
You know, which can be really exhausting and tiring and hard to keep up with. I also think that it's not necessarily something that you need to keep up with all the time.
Right.
I think what you can do is you can kind of do sprints of it where you learn some, you know, you learn whatever things you feel you need to catch up.
Yeah.
And then you use those for a while. And then, I don't know, 6 months, a year down the line, you do another sprint of learning some things.
I think that's the benefit of working with an agency style business is that you get every project is a greenfield project.
Mm-hmm.
At least, you know, within reason, there's of course stuff you support that's legacy or stuff you maintain. But like, when a new client signs, like, you're not going to use something that you used 2 years ago for, if you know there's something that'll solve the problem either more efficiently, better, it'll give the client more value, it's cheaper for you to take care of, like, all these things, all these different services, all these like SaaS and PaaS app platforms and stuff like that. Like, you can use those instead of, you know, oh, I want to roll my own socket server, or like I can use like a tool like Pusher, like, or I can use Firebase to like handle all my data and my uploads and all this other stuff. But yeah, I think that that general statement, I think, is probably like the main vein of this whole conversation is like, yeah, this stuff is there's a lot of stuff to know.
Yeah,
I'll do my next one until we go too far down a rabbit hole. But I wrote, I think there's a trend in mine. Mine are probably more specific than yours, at least right now. My next one was authentication.
Oh, yeah.
So like
authentication or authorization? Or are you?
I think you could probably... I don't know. I wrote down authentication, so I'll probably stick with that.
Sure.
So like, okay, so there's some stuff where it's like when I first encountered like someone logging into something, I'm like, yeah, they just, you come, write your username, write your password, click login, and boom, you logged in. I'm like, cool, that's easy. Then someone's like, oh, I want you to like add it. So like, oh, your first name is required. And you're like, oh, okay. So I think I was working for a guy doing freelance work, and he had bought some sort of like CRM off of like one of those like ThemeForest sites.
Yeah.
Where you can like buy like prepackaged applications for like you to later modify. Mm-hmm. And so I was like diving through the code, like looking for certain words that I knew existed, like the word username. And like I was basically like searching it through the code, trying to figure out how to like change this thing because I had no idea how it worked. Yeah. I had no idea like what a cookie was or like what a session was or any of that stuff. I didn't know that like how the password was stored in the database or anything like that. I didn't know that it was like, when I looked in the database, I'm like, wow, this is all like crazy text. Like their password is this crazy text. I didn't even know what like a hash was. I didn't know what salting was. I didn't know any of this stuff. So,
or even just the fact that to be logged in, you have to have a state.
Yeah.
You know, like
and where is it stored?
Yeah.
Like where is there... Is the database like have like logged in like as a column that's like a one or a zero? Like I had no idea how that worked. And like now working with these more complicated projects where it's like we have an API, you authenticate, like now the authentication options are like, you know, we could do a whole show on the different varieties of types of authentication you could use, or like protocols, mm-hmm. OAuth, OAuth 2, JWT, like a bearer token, authentication via like some other kind of secret session token or cookies. headers, or do you put in the header? Do you put in the body? Yeah. Do you use a custom header? Do you use an authorization header? Like, do you have like, do you pass some sort of secret? Like, there's all this crazy stuff that you can do.
Yep.
And it's like, oh my gosh, like if you do it wrong, it's not good either, because it means like, you know, people might be seeing other people's stuff, or you might not be able to log in. You might just try to use it and it just doesn't work.
Yeah.
So I had that issue when I was doing JWT for the first time, JSON Web Token. I was like trying to, like, I didn't really understand it. So I'm like, I don't get how it works. Like, authenticated, but then it expired. And like, how do I know that it's expired? And like, how do I refresh the token? And like,
yep,
all this stuff. But like,
well, just from something that's session based to the whole concept of stateless JWT type of stuff.
Yeah.
You have to think differently. Like you can't use all the assumptions that you used to have.
Yeah.
And that's honestly, you could put that idea into any other area of programming where as soon as you change just a few things, suddenly the whole way of thinking about it is different now, you know, like, or even go something larger, object oriented to functional programming. Like, again, it's one of those things where what you thought you knew is no longer applicable.
Right.
And so like authentication, if you do it wrong, you're not just affecting authentication, you're affecting authorization, which, you know, that's basically permissions to do things. Can this person do this thing, and are they allowed to do it?
Yeah.
Authentication is, you know, are they this user?
Yeah.
I could definitely see authentication. I guess it's been long enough now that I didn't even think of that as something to think about. And the other thing is, so many frameworks these days will give you the groundwork for that.
Yeah.
But if you're doing anything out of the ordinary, you'll run into it again. And because you probably haven't touched it in a while, because they do that for you, it can be a real problem.
Well, the reason I wrote it down was because today I had a conversation with someone about, how do you do OAuth with an SPA?
Mm.
So like, normally when you do OAuth, you have to do like the redirect, like you basically get redirected to the service you want to log into.
Yep.
Using the application secret and their token, or they're using the credentials for the application you want to authorize through the second party.
Yeah.
So you go to their site, you log into your account, you say, yeah, I accept that I want this application to use my stuff. Then you go back to the application you were on.
Right.
But like, that token that gets passed around, whether it's the one that you're using as yourself as the app, or the token you get back from the user as a representation of their account,
mm-hmm.
like, where do you put that? Because the SPA is stateless. You can't really store it in there. And how do you get it back to your API? Another challenge is, some, depending on the service that you're using, they require domain whitelists. And there's like one domain. And it's like, well, if you have an API on one subdomain or on a different domain, and your SPA is on a different domain, is that going to work?
Yeah.
I don't really know. So like, I've never done that.
I haven't done enough stuff with SPAs to even have thought about that. But yeah, I could see tons of problems going on there.
Yeah, there's a lot of challenges there. So I'm like, oh, okay, that's an interesting predicament that I've never encountered. Because like, I'm just getting on the single page application like bandwagon about like when it makes sense, and like, we're, oh, okay, this application makes sense. We have things we want to happen while browsing around the site. Cool. That makes a perfect case for a single page application. But we're authenticating with Stripe Connect. Yeah. So how are we going to do that? Because it's OAuth. So what's the dance? What's the OAuth dance now? Because it's very different from when you have a website, quote unquote, classic approach.
Yeah, the OAuth dance is one that I first ran into in university, actually, doing something with the Twitter API.
You can't say you didn't learn anything.
Yeah, well,
you learned OAuth.
I guess, yeah. I'm not even sure that was for university. It might have just been at the time.
You happen to be in university.
Happen to be in university. But I remember just being so frustrated with it, because I was just thinking, like, why do we need all this goofy stuff? Like, why can't I just give you like a regular login type of situation? And I get it now, in that, you know, if you're going to have applications talk to each other in a standardized way, you need to make them secure enough to handle all the different situations. But it's still, it's not an easy thing to pick up. It's a huge jump from going from some of the more basic stuff to even something that's as prevalent as OAuth that, like, yeah. maybe an experienced developer might think, oh, well, I've done OAuth a million times. Like, no problem. We'll just do the usual OAuth dance. But to someone new, like, you're blowing their mind here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, imagine going from, like, using WordPress to, like, oh, they log in and, like, they can see stuff because they're logged in to, like, going to a stateless JWT with OAuth social login.
Yep.
Quite a gap between those two.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't want to harp on it too much. We'll move on to the next one. So what's your next one?
Sure. So my next one, I think mine are maybe a little more abstract or like a little bit less specific than yours. But so I said the whole practice of development is a very subjective science. So best practices for any given instance, anything you're trying to do, are pretty hard to determine.
Yeah.
So kind of touching on the wide range of knowledge from the last point that I had, but if you go in, let's say you have a new project, you're looking to build something that has users and it's got posts. Oh, it's a blog.
Oh, yeah. Sounds like a blog.
Sure. So you might think that you have the best way to do this. Like, everybody knows how a blog works. Here's how you make a blog. This is how we do it. Mm-hmm. That community over there has one idea. This community over here has a different idea. And so do the other 30 down the line. All of them have good things and have upsides and downsides. Some of them might be completely contradictory and different.
Mm-hmm.
How do you know which one is the best way to do this? There is no best practice in development. And it's a word that we use a lot in the industry. Best practices, best security practices, best practices for anything. And I would argue that most of the time, there is no single best practice. There are bad or there are worse practices and there are better practices given your goals and the situation and the context, but you can do things a million different ways. And so it's really, really hard to figure out which one to do sometimes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you just have to take a shot and do it. That analysis paralysis can really kick in as a developer. I find that's something where the times where I struggle the most with this are not the times where everything seems like a bad option or I'm just trying to find one option. It's when I have three or four good options. Any of them would be great.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to find out which is the best one.
I think the really sad thing about that too is, like, you might inherit a legacy project that someone's like, man, we think we chose the right thing. And, like, a year later, someone new comes along and they need to add one feature. Mm-hmm. It's like, why did they do it this way? Now my job is so hard.
Yeah.
And, like, yeah, I guess you can, like, rail on the person that was last on the project and stuff. But at the same time, it's like they might have picked, like, that might have been absolutely, like to a T exactly what that project needed at the time. Mm-hmm. But now they want something very different. Their business model's changed maybe and they need a new feature in this application or whatever. Mm-hmm. And now that thing is really difficult to facilitate. So what's the deal? Is that person wrong? Are you trying to fit something as the round peg square hole problem? Like, what do you do? Mm-hmm. Do you file down the edges? Like, what do you do? Like,
how do you deal with that as a team?
Yeah, it's, you know, kind of crazy.
When maybe both of you are right. Like, either way is fine, but you both have fundamentally a strong disagreement in the way that this should work. It could be a real problem. I think that's why culture fit is such a big thing in the industry is, you know, you go to work somewhere and, like, half of the interview is them trying to figure out, is this person going to be good to work with in person or when I have to interact with them, is it going to be a problem? Yeah. And I suspect a lot of that has less to do with, is this person really smart? Does this person know all the things they need to know? Because for one thing, that's very hard to determine. And often I think a lot of employers aren't necessarily super worried about that because you can train people up, that kind of thing. But is there going to be a major difference of style, opinions, things like that, that will lead to work not getting done.
Yeah, or you know? Like work not getting done, or just like rabbit-holing, you know, armchair opinions, like saying, oh, we shouldn't have done that. It's like, well, yeah, hindsight's 20/20.
Yeah.
So that's a big challenge too, is like we said earlier, like you never know more about a project than you do at the end or after it's over. So
yeah,
it's kind of look back and like look at everyone and be like, wow, what were you thinking?
Yeah.
Like, well,
it's really easy to bash something that's already done.
I couldn't see the future. So, you know, give me a break.
Yeah.
Cool. I have another one. So this one's another one. That's a big one. So I wrote down security.
Yeah. Security is
security is,
we could do entire episodes on this.
You could have a whole show dedicated to web app security.
There's got to be a podcast about this. If there isn't, someone please make one, because I'll listen to it.
Yeah, for sure. So like just like authentication, which ties into security quite heavily, you have other things like you said, like authorization, or even just like, are you storing that person's file properly? Like, are you encrypting your, are you hashing and salting your passwords? Are you encrypting things when you need to? Are you compliant with like things like HIPAA, or even things like
PCI?
When you're storing like credit cards and stuff, if you have to store that information, which these days there's not usually a good reason to do it, but
no, I ran into something. I ran into something a little while ago where they had all of the fields and everything for this. They weren't storing the information, but it was just in the system. Like it was just there were models for it and things, but no one, it was never storing any actual real data. And something like that, if you don't know it, that's enough to cause you problems with PCI compliance. Right. Just having the code in there, even though you're not using it. If you ever got audited or something like that, that could land you in trouble.
Yeah.
I think a lot of security is, it's not even knowing, again, best practices.
Yeah.
How do you know what that is? But it depends on where you're operating out of. What are the laws there? There's a lot going on. There's a lot of variables.
You could bump into a federal law writing a website.
Yeah.
Which is kind of weird to think about.
Another country's law. Like,
yeah, absolutely.
Is someone from Brazil opening up your website from Canada? Well, they might have a different law there, and maybe it doesn't matter to you because you're not going to Brazil and you're never going to get caught for it. But, you know, if you're Facebook, or if you're anyone of any prevalence with that kind of stuff, like, that's something you have to take very seriously, because you're breaking laws.
A timely thing now is the Equifax hack.
Yeah, exactly.
So there goes almost 150 million people had their critical financial details leaked.
Their identities, essentially.
Basically, their identity and all of their financial transactions from, you know, could be decades. So that's an issue. Not great. And the crazy thing about too, it is like these laws are in place, but no one's enforcing them. And like the company like barely even gets fined and stuff like this. I was watching a thing on Vice about it. Basically, people are like, yeah, nothing's really, can't really do much about it. It kind of sucks. Maybe some private citizens will try to sue. But like being embroiled in a lawsuit is not great.
Yeah, yeah. No one wins in a lawsuit.
Yeah.
Usually,
except for the lawyers.
Yeah, except for the lawyers. But typically, like if you're getting into a lawsuit, a lot of the time it's because that was the last real option.
Yeah.
But even in a case like that, like, which seems like it would be the ideal civil suit to sue someone over.
Sure.
You know, like, you owe me a bunch of money because you could potentially ruin my life with this.
Yeah, because
especially
I could have
financially.
No money.
Yeah. This is it's a very easy thing to draw lines between. But yeah, like, it's the Wild West on most things.
Yeah.
Even private health information in Canada, the regulations on it are the penalties and consequences of failing them are fairly harsh, and so you have to take them very seriously, but they're pretty vague.
Yeah.
I've dealt with these things, and some of them, they don't specify anything real. You know, it says within reason quite a bit. It says things like to the best ability capable or something like that, you know. And it's like, well, what does that even mean?
Like super subjective language.
to what level are we encrypting things, and does that mean a steel door on a server room, or does it mean
chicken wire?
You just have to have a password on the account, or two-factor auth. It could be anything. I've seen and there's very little oversight, there's very little consequences a lot of the time, and honestly, I think it would probably cost a ton of money to figure that stuff out. But yeah, security is easily one of the most difficult things in development. I think very few people know about it, and there's not that many places to learn.
Well, I think unfortunately a lot of people rely on the defaults. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, like, a lot of these languages that we're using are like, there's a few languages that are quite a bit newer, but even like some of the newest languages are like, oh, the newest language is like 5 years old. Like, mm-hmm. 5 years ago, our computers were radically different.
Yeah.
Like, our computers now, like, having a, like, MD5, you can create a collision if you want.
Yep.
You can create collisions in MD5. SHA-256, quite a bit harder. SHA-512, way harder.
Yeah.
SHA-1024, way, way harder. So it's about trying to make sensible defaults, too, is what people try to push for things like libsodium. Yep. The tool or the library for salting and hashing and encrypting things. Even OpenSSL has been criticized for having like strange or like very weak defaults for some things. Even like SSL.
Yeah.
SSL just got bumped to the next level of hashing from one that was like considered quite weak even like years ago.
Yeah. And what happens to the things that we think are impossible to break right now when we make advances in things like quantum computing, for instance, which are almost tailor-made for breaking things like encryption. Yeah. Like that's what they do is, as far as I know, I don't know a lot about quantum computing, but doesn't it do a lot of things like parallel computing really quickly? And
it's basically like computing all options at once.
Yeah, like all the really hard math problems that we make a lot of assumptions with security on seem to be... they play by different rules when it comes to things like quantum computing. And so I think a lot of people, they worry about the security of today, which is probably the only reasonable thing that you can do. But for instance, if you're uploading your own data to like maybe something that's really important that no one else ever sees, I don't know what that is, but mm-hmm. maybe it's something in the government, let's say. 50 years down the line, the technology being so different, something we can't even imagine right now, breaking that encryption, which on data that is public but encrypted, is not at all outside of the realm of possibility. So, like, what is good security at this point?
Like, good security seems like a moving line in the sand, which you're always trying to catch up to. Is like, well, that was good like 2 years ago, but you got to do this now.
Yeah.
Oh, that'll be good for 2 years from now, but we got to do this because it'll be good for 20 years from now.
Yep.
Oh, we got to do this because, you know, this compliance is new or something. I think even simple things like, well, are you protecting certain files from being listed to a search mm-hmm. engine? I had that issue once. Like, I had a mm-hmm. client that had, they wanted to have a file, they wanted to basically download a CSV of like people that had filled in like a form.
Yep.
And it wrote a file to a public folder so they could come back and download it later.
Yeah.
Or something. It was some sort of like, they wanted some sort of like, arguably like much smoother user experience. It, mm-hmm. But the problem was it really like there was basically just nuked the whole security of the thing. Like you could just visit the file, even if you weren't logged in, and like download a list of all the people that filled out their form.
Yeah.
Like, oops. Anyone could just like, it would, the search engine crawled it. Like someone found it and was like, hey, I found a list of like all your users.
Yeah.
Like,
and their emails. And yeah. Now their emails are on my list.
Yeah. Now I can sell this to a spam bot.
Yeah. It's
like, whoopsie.
Well, and with security, you also dip into things that may have nothing to do with laws or like liability or ramifications that way. It could just be something morally or ethically wrong or you know, things you need to consider. So, for instance, if you use something like Google Drive, and I haven't read all of their licensing and their regulations and things that they have you sign, mm-hmm. but I would guess that you're giving them basically your information. You're saying you can do whatever you want with this. They're saying, well, we promise we'll probably keep it safe or whatever. Yeah. But I bet you in their documentation it says they can do whatever they want with it. And so at that point, like, they're not held by any law to prevent them from releasing that to third parties or whatever. Mm-hmm. Maybe morally they are. So, you know, that's something you need to think about with security too, is am I doing what's just required or am I doing what is good? And doing what is good sometimes is much more difficult. What efforts and lengths do you go to protect information that's within reason?
Yeah.
You know, if you know that there's someone out there that, you know, if the NSA, for instance, can break these encryptions and these things, do you worry about it? They're the NSA. Like, you can't really stop them if you're an average developer, probably. Like, the odds of you stopping an organization like that are low.
They're going to find
a way. Is it, you know, you could make tons of arguments about, like, is it your moral imperative that you do that, or you don't make the thing you're making? Like, where's the
line? Well, I mean, depending on who you ask on what political side, someone might be like, yeah, you should definitely let the NSA, like, look at your stuff. And then someone might be like, you should never let anyone look at your stuff. So there's, even depending on who you ask, the answer is different. And that's, like, not even about security. It's about, who's got access to the data?
Then you're just pretty much entirely in the realm of philosophy too. You know, moral quandaries. So yeah, security is a really tough thing.
Next one. What's your next one?
The next one I have is just that it's mentally taxing to code. And so this is more to do with implementation, not necessarily to do with managing teams or working in teams, that kind of thing. But just strictly when you have a hard problem coding, you're holding a lot in your head. You're dealing with a lot of variables, and it's something that you have to update and change in your head all the time when you're doing it. So let's say you have a problem like, like we were talking earlier about doing custom reports for different users' needs and things like that.
Yeah.
When you're sitting down to figure out that problem, if someone saw you sitting there, they would think you were doing nothing, because you're sitting there in your chair just visualizing, probably.
Like holding your chin.
Yeah, at the very least for a few minutes. Like, it could be hours. It could be anything.
Yeah.
And then when you actually start implementing it, you have to hold all of that in your head as a system. And when you decide it might be better to do something this way, you have to update that model in your head. It's not a small thing, and it's easily interrupted and broken.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that again, like, that's a pretty abstract idea, I know, but dealing with just the mental aspect of coding, and it's not completely unique with development. Like, there are other professions and things out there that do this same kind of thing. I suspect that, like, complicated art has the same issue, where you're holding a lot of things in your head,
mm-hmm.
and you're trying to make some vision you have come true and become reality.
Yeah.
But it's definitely, I've definitely come out of coding sessions where it's been 4 or 5 hours. I have no idea how much time has passed. It's almost like blacking out sometimes, because you're that focused, and you're holding so many things that you can't think about anything else for a while.
Well, I mean, there's all those memes online about developers, like, coming back to the project the next day and being like, wow, this works?
Yeah.
Or like, oh, this is terrible. Yeah. Like, who snuck in and wrote this when I was sleeping?
Yeah, I think developers, we have a really bad habit of writing things well past the point when we should still be writing code, so we're really tired or we're really stressed out or whatever. And that's when you come back the next day, or maybe a week later or something, you've had some rest, you've had some time to cool off and think and reset, and you look at the code, and sometimes it's brilliant, and you're like, I couldn't recreate that right now. I could not come up with something this good.
I was like in a zone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or it could be like, this is garbage, and I don't recognize the person that wrote this.
Yeah. Whoever wrote this should be killed.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's terrible.
Yeah.
And I see both sides of that often enough, just for myself, that I think mentally managing yourself as a developer is something that's really important. You need to cultivate a calm mentality a lot of the time, calm mm-hmm. and focused, because it's hard to be creative when you're not calm, and mm-hmm. it's hard to actually get anything done when you're not focused, when something has that much, that many variables to it, that much to hold in your head. If you can't focus, then you're not going to be able to actually implement it.
Sure.
So I think that's one of those things where, I know a lot of other developers I've talked to, that's one of the first things they talk about when they have problems with like meetings and things like that, because it breaks that flow.
Yeah. The context switching too can be really incredibly like, exhausting.
Yeah. Context switching is hard. But yeah, just in general, like if you're not managing your mental state and yourself in that way, your development, like your output and your productivity can go down the tubes for weeks at a time sometimes. And a lot of it, you know, that can stretch out into other things like exercise, like just mental health in general, I think is like a something that people are talking about a lot now. Definitely. These days.
I was going to say, I think the culture of things like taking half the day to like work from home.
Yeah.
Is like, you'll never be more, hopefully your home is the most comfortable place on the planet for you.
Yep.
So working from home can actually, you can gain a lot of things. Maybe you're not necessarily gaining productivity in the literal sense, but maybe you are doing that sort of mental relaxation. Yeah. Oh, like I'm in my kitchen and I moved 5 feet over to my desk and I sat down and I pet my dog and started working on the computer.
Yeah.
Cool. Like that might be, that's a lot more calm than like the commute into the office and, you know, running up the stairs and having that first meeting, and the noisy office is the first thing you're greeted with when you come in, and that you're waiting in line to get a coffee and you sit down at your computer and you got 17 emails and oh my God, like it's quite a bit different from like waking up and sitting at your computer at home with no one else around.
It can go both ways though too. So I work from home all the time, pretty much. But I definitely, like I have some clients where I'm in their office. Sometimes I'm working with other developers, I'm working in a team, and sometimes in 2 hours we come up with something that like I would not have been able to come up with by myself. It's a great solution. We get everything done in that afternoon, and it's like, wow, this, you know, this team atmosphere, it worked really well. I think it's just the right context for the right things at the right times, which is, you know, it's, again, it's tough to figure that stuff out. But yeah, that context switching can be really helpful, and just generally managing mental state is it's a lot of the ball game.
Write a program to manage your mental state.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Mental state management. following into my my little trend here, I'm talking about something that's relatively specific in comparison. Perfect. I wrote down caching.
Naming and caching, the two most difficult things.
You hit the other thing. So I wrote down naming things right after that, which that was what I said about copying out.
I just ruined it for you. Sorry.
But that's what I said about copying out. I was like, oh, I'm gonna pick two that I know everyone's going to agree with because of that silly joke.
So
I thought caching, like I actually have been, I was dealing with a caching issue for one of the larger projects I finished where we had this really sophisticated search that would search across a lot of different columns and tables of different it was searching off across a lot of columns and tables, doing a ton of joins and stuff.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to put a 5-minute cache on this thing. I'm going to put a debounce on the front end, which basically is you type 3 characters and then the last character, it waits before it does the search. So basically I'm not hammering the server for every key up.
Yep.
So I was doing things like that. And like, I basically, you can apply some filters and stuff. So this thing starts to get really complicated really quickly. And I'm like, you know what? I can't just hammer the server like every time someone like changes a dropdown, if someone like literally just came and searched the same thing.
Yeah.
So I basically cached the query as a big long combination of the form inputs as a string. So basically, you know, each request would be unique based on what they're typing in.
Right.
So, but then we had issues where, you know, they'd do a search for someone and they'd click on their profile and they would see some different information. Like maybe their first name is like different when I clicked on it, or like, oh, there's something here I didn't see last time, or like their member type has changed, or their user type has changed, or they have new properties in that didn't show in the search results.
Yeah.
And so I had the search on a 5-minute hard limit. So basically it would reset every 5 minutes, but like the other parts of the application, those caches were cleared either 5 minutes or if they were edited. So by editing the profile of the user, it would clear the cache, but the search was still unaffected. So, you know, I had no reasonable way to clear the search cache by one profile out of 4,000. Like, mm-hmm. I just had no reasonable way to... How am I supposed to know that that person's in the search results set?
Yeah.
Like, I just have no real reasonable approach for that.
Yep.
So, like, that was really difficult because, like, explaining to the client was like, hey, I can turn this cache off, but, like, you're not going to have the same sort of performance that you're feeling right now. Like, especially yeah. over the day and, like, as the cache gets warmed up and you, like, might search the same things, you might be searching for similar types of people. They can type in, like, certain phrases and certain results will show up.
Yep.
And, like, even just browsing around the site generally, like, if I keep clearing the cache, like, constantly, you're not going to have as smooth an experience, considering how, like, sophisticated some of the profiles of these users are.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
like, oh, boy, like, explaining that to someone, like, just, like, explaining it now is, like, that's a lot of mental baggage to unload onto someone and be like, yeah, okay, so this is how it works. This yeah. is why we're doing it. Here's how I'm doing it now to make it work. Like, I don't always go that technical. I'm like, hey, we cache things to, like, make the site faster, improve the experience. We don't want people waiting. Like, I talk about the benefits, never like the implementation, but
right.
still difficult challenge because, you know, the first thing they do is complain that it's slow, but then they complain that things are out of date. So it's like, well, we actually can't have both in this scenario.
Yeah. Yeah. That's definitely caching, cache busting, all of that stuff. Super, super difficult. To confess something here, I rarely use caches.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, most of the time I'm not using a cache, and most of the time when I am using a cache, it's because we hit some optimization problem where without a cache, this thing will not work at some point. Like, we're hitting the scale right. where it's a problem, and I'm certain we're losing some performance there. But definitely, like, that's how hard caching is a lot of the time and how frustrating it is to deal with. That we'll completely forgo it on
mm-hmm.
on the outset of every project. We just completely assume we're not caching anything,
yeah.
and then later on, if we have to, we do it because holy hell!
getting into it on
even small problems. Like, that, I would say that, like, in that instance, that's something that, like, on the surface of it, you might look at it and go like, oh, this is a fairly small problems, very small caching.
Yeah.
Like, we're searching some users, like, no big deal.
Yeah.
But you could burn so much time just dealing with that and the little idiosyncrasies and strangenesses that will
yeah.
come out of that. I hate caching. I hate it with a passion. I completely understand its use. I get its benefits. But yeah, I'm one of those people who, the way I get around that is I just avoid it if I can.
Yeah, it's a thing that's like, there's elegance in the implementation, but it's rarely elegantly implemented.
Yes.
So it's very crude sometimes where it's like, you wait 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Then you get the new stuff.
Yeah.
So like yeah. with them.
We're just going to hard reset this cache every 5 minutes.
Oh yeah. Like, like on deploys, it'd be like, yeah. yeah, we deployed some new code, time to nuke the cache. And the whole site is like slow for 30 minutes.
Yeah.
Like I've had situations where it's like the only tool I could reach for was caching.
Yeah.
So that would be, I had a site that would, it was a site for buses. And so these parents would come and visit the site. They'd hammer the site every weekday morning.
Yeah.
So we would get 30,000 sessions in an hour.
Yeah.
Like,
perfect time for cache.
It would kill yeah. the site. And so basically we went to a level 4 load balancer. So we had the load balancer, database server, and then 2 app servers.
Right.
And then so those had caches. The load balancer had a cache. Like, there's caching all over the place because, like, the site just wouldn't stay up.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, throwing more servers at it wasn't really working.
No.
Even like boosting the servers wasn't working. It was just like, it was inefficiencies in the code that would be like, oh, this yeah. thing crashes because it times out.
Or a lot of the time it's because you're dealing with accessing data.
Yeah.
And the only way to speed that up without doing something like a cache is to literally start replicating or sharding and things like that.
Yeah.
Which I guarantee you is going to be at least as much work as building up a proper cache.
Yeah. So that was the thing where I was like, okay, I need to learn how do you access a cluster of web servers behind a load balancer that's also cached.
Mm-hmm.
How do you, going back to authentication, how do I log into this thing?
Yeah.
How do I log into a sharded application through a load balancer?
Yeah.
So, like, okay, that's an interesting problem. finally got it working. But it was like one of these things where it was like, oh my God, like I'm learning a bunch of new tools. I'm learning a bunch of new ways to use things like headers and sessions and cookies and even like cache hit and miss. And like when I want to trigger one, when I want to clear one, how do I make sure that these sites at when they update the site, it's not out of date, like in the cache, like, oh man, just a ton of issues and like tons of like, I basically had to onboard myself into like a sophisticated application system from just running like what was otherwise a pretty straightforward website. Mm-hmm. It got hammered with traffic.
Yep.
I mean, that probably would have been a good time to reach for a tool like a Cloudflare or something like that. Like in hindsight, that probably would have been much more reasonable.
Let someone else figure out caching.
Yeah. Like we'll just throw money at it. We'll just throw money at it. Basically. Like, we won't throw tools and technology at it. We're just going to throw money at it.
Lot of the time, depending on, you know, how the project's working out, the money that you're going to throw at that, like you could throw 3 years worth of someone else fixing that problem for you in the amount of time that it's going to take you to solve that anyways.
Yeah.
Like services, because they're so widely, they can widely distribute to millions of users across the world. You get that, the economy of scale there. So
yeah,
you know, something like Cloudflare can offer their stuff quite cheaply.
Yeah.
So yeah, definitely. I can't believe I didn't think of caching. That's such an obvious go-to for that.
So I don't know if you want to talk about naming things, because that was the other thing I wrote down.
Yeah, let's bring up naming things, because I feel like that's something that is actually sort of related to that in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
So naming things is like one of my favorite things that I do.
Oh, really?
And
I hate caching. You love naming.
I hate caching. Love naming things. Naming and like not just in programming, just everything.
Yeah.
If we're trying to come up with a trivia team name, yeah, I want to name it. You know, yeah, like whatever it is. I love naming things.
Yeah.
And with naming things, I think one of the biggest problems is often that there's a bunch of things that could work, and you're looking for the best, so you're optimizing, which is a way harder problem than finding the one right solution. You're finding the best solution,
right,
out of many possible good ones.
Right.
Again, the psychology of choices, and that is difficult for people. But also naming comes along with a lot of baggage.
Yeah.
Like, for instance, we were talking about workshop flows recently.
Right.
And
for event storming and stuff like that.
Yeah, running exactly.
Running a workshop.
And so just trying to name some very simple things that on the surface you're thinking like, well, what's an event? Like, well, actually people have all kinds of different ideas of what an event is, or a task, or anything.
Yeah.
You name it. It's,
you bring the baggage of your experience to every interaction.
Yeah.
So,
and your context,
how do you
generalize? And that could be something that's different among like people who speak different languages from different cultures. They think about things differently. And so, I mean, in programming, things tend to get named English stuff,
mm-hmm,
because that seems to be the underlying language of the internet, at least in development.
Yeah.
But that's a difficult thing. So think about someone who, for instance, originally speaks, I was going to say German, but that's actually one of the closest languages to English. So let's go with something more like Mandarin.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to name things in English in development, that's a really hard thing to do, because naming things is all about context.
Yeah.
And you may not have the same context that you might have as a Canadian person who has spoken English their entire life, but even you with someone from Texas, like that word might mean something completely different to them.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things where you pick it and you think, ah, we can change it later and whatever. And it just bubbles up and percolates throughout the entire rest of the system, how you build everything. The way you think about things changes.
Mm-hmm.
So if you called users accounts, you might change the way that you treat users or accounts now, if you're calling them
that. Even like crossing into the domain.
Exactly.
Domain-driven design approach is like, well, mm-hmm, what words are we using?
Yeah.
Like, how are we describing our domain? And like, that's important in the team. But then when someone joins the team, they're like, this is an account, but like in the database, it's like a user, but like we call it username, but there's an account, but there's a profile, but there's a type, but it's a profile type, not a user type or an account type.
An account has a person in it, but they're not the account, but yeah. They are the user.
Yeah, it's
or so like what's going on
my
here?
Favorite thing is the vague that are like the words we use for like thingy, the development version thingy. Of thingy.
Yeah,
I have a couple. I have data.
Yeah,
so like data is used thrown around constantly.
Handler
is a great one. Payload is another payload. One. Payload. Yeah. Another one. One of my favorites is items.
Yeah,
items. Repository is another one that I see a lot.
I hate the word repository.
Also, collection. Like, oh, we have. I've called things collection before when I'm like summing results of like you know I'm maybe like mapping over a bunch of arrays or whatever.
Yep.
It's like, do I call this items? Do I call it collection? What vague representation of exactly the very specific thing that I did? What do I name the result of that? Result is another one that I use a lot. Like, you know, return result.
Index
is a
like,
great
well
one.
Like index is a specific thing, but how often do you use index for things where like I probably shouldn't be using index here, but I'm lazy.
Yeah,
you
like know? I've iterated over arrays where the index was actually the key of the array. Yeah, but sure. I've called it index.
Yeah,
you're doing like, eh, it's kind of
index
synonymous
thrown,
with key
thrown and... around. I mean, it's not you're not using index for 100 different things, but you might use it for 5 different things and then it gets really confusing.
Yeah I won't harp on the things like I for for loops and stuff, but
I think that's just kind of like general practice. I think most people are at the point where they kind of get like it's worth being a little bit more verbose and you know writing out longer names for things because they're easier to read. You write something, you know, once or twice or whatever, and you read it a million times.
When I sometimes teach at one of the like code schools here in town, and one of the things that I always tell the students, I'm like, don't call something like items or like data. I'm like, give it a crazy name that's super specific for what you're doing.
Yeah.
Because I found a lot of the time is like these students, they'd be like, they're trying to learn JavaScript and they're also trying to like wrangle what they're doing.
They're trying to mentally hold everything in their head and
they're
it's
like,
brand new.
So they have limited mental RAM. Like they can't hold, they can't even, they're and trying to learn and memorize like what they're doing. So I'm like, okay, so one of the examples is like they're looping over an array. And they're just like, maybe they're like adding one to every value or something like that. Or they're going to be like, oh, like they're going to split the array in two because like, oh, if it's greater than 3, put it in here. If it's not, then put it in here.
Yeah.
So basically I'm like, call this one array of items less than 3. Call this one array of items greater than 3. If I look at your code and you look at your code tomorrow, are you going to be able to tell me what that is?
Yeah.
It says what it is. It tells you what it is. You don't have to ask what it is. You don't have to like console log like, oh, what was it? What was this thing? I called it like array 1 and array 2. Okay, well, that's brutal.
An array of what?
Array of what? Like
for
why?
What purpose?
Exactly. Yeah. So like I use that advice. Like I don't necessarily subscribe to it all the time, but the thing is like I have 7 years on these kids, so I think I can usually deal with it in a different way. But for them, it's like I found that was supremely helpful, not just for like their JavaScript, but also for like CSS.
Yeah.
Call this like page title, home page title wrapper.
Yep.
Home page title title. Like call it something super specific.
You could get into a big argument there with the utility classes and the BEM people and all of that stuff,
so
which
I
don't know that much about. But
so I use utility classes too. Like I have classes that are like M0. Okay, well, what does that mean?
Yeah, I don't like that. So I have no problem with the idea of utility classes. I just think that they should be named more descriptive things.
Yeah.
I mean, think like, people default to really short stuff because they write a lot of them, but I don't know if that's the best.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's another thing of, like, naming things is, like, my convention is different than your convention. Like, another thing is, like, I see a lot of the kids, they'll come in and it's, like, their CSS classes are, like, all, like, maybe their title case.
Mm-hmm.
Title case, they might be like title camel case or like they might be lower snake case or they're like slugified like dashes and stuff. So like they have mixed casing too. And that was some other advice that again, I'm like, okay, just do everything lowercase.
Yeah.
Unless it's two words in JavaScript, do lower snake case or lower camel case, whatever you call it.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah. Cause if you just do these two things and then like I was telling them, okay, like when I'm working on a program, and you know, I get further down the page. I don't have to scroll back to remember what I named the variable. Like I know the name was like items, a great name.
Yeah.
The fabulous name. But like, I might call it like, you know, maybe I called it like array of items less than three.
Yeah.
Well, I know I didn't start with capital A. And I know I didn't put underscores between all the words. And I know I didn't put the second word as lowercase as well. So like, I have my own personal rules. Yep. And so when I'm working on my own personal projects, I can actually make a lot of progress by not even looking back, because I already know intuitively what I would have done. The problem is when I join someone else's project and we don't follow the same conventions, it can be a little trickier, which is why I've come around to things like PSR2 and PSR4 in PHP, because they're like, hey, just do everything the same. Like, everyone just agree to like format their code the same, like Python style.
Yep.
Or like Golang style. Like, just go ahead and format all your stuff the same, and we'll all just like look at it the same, and we can all look at each other's projects and know what the hell's going on.
Yep.
And everyone's like, fine. I mean, there's a lot of people that still don't agree, but like,
Josh, no, but I think standardization of things that don't matter is always a good idea.
Yeah.
Because those are easy things to fix that will not cause any problems if they're fixed, but will cause problems if they're not.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, like, how many times have you had like a reference error in JavaScript? You're like, this thing is defined, and you go back and you're like, oh, I spelled it wrong.
Yeah.
Damn it.
Yeah.
Like, whoops.
Undefined. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely naming, easily one of the top three here, I would say.
So, what's your last one?
So my last one is the human factor. So people create uncertainty. So at the top of my list here, humans. I put TLDR uncertainty. So all of my things have to do with uncertainty.
Oh, yeah.
I realized afterwards, I was reading through them and I went, well, all of these are kind of getting at the same thing, which is when you introduce uncertainty into any project or anything like that, and people are the ultimate uncertainty creator.
Yeah.
So
their whim, their wants and needs changes with the wind.
We're whimsical creatures. The other thing is, so you've got it on many sides here, that's not a good phrase to use right now. So people create uncertainty. They introduce error and they multiply all the problems we've talked about.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of different people though here you could be talking about. So we could be talking about the developer or the developing team themselves. So if you have one developer that wants to do things one way, another developer wants to do things another way, not productive usually, and creates a problem. Or you could have just a single developer being lazy or something, you know, like anything. They're not commenting where they should be. They're not following.
Their commits are really vague and like,
yeah, their commits are vague. Like, they're not following the style guide or whatever. Yeah.
They're not testing before they commit or whatever.
Sure. But then you've also got things like you can move up levels to project managers, and then you've got layers of confusion and different contexts, and then you've also got a separation of what of understanding between people. So you've got one project manager who may be looking at things in terms of features, deliverables, time, things like that. And you're thinking of things in terms of, you know, functions and caching and naming stuff. Yeah. You know, like, that's what you're worried about. Then take it all the way out to things like clients or customers. So a client first could be any, honestly, so many problems, but a client, they have all these expectations, ideas, understandings, misunderstandings, their own context. There's everything that goes into that, which basically creates, it's like you have to create a bridge or an adapter there for every single different
client. An interface?
Client. Yeah, an interface.
Client interface?
But every client's different. So
yeah,
like anytime you're going to need to tweak it for every single different client.
Yeah.
So that's its own thing. And then you expand it out to say, if you're building products or a platform or anything like that, you have users, and users are it's just many clients basically. Like I love when people say, oh, we build products and we don't have clients. I'm like, no, you just have a lot of clients.
Yeah.
You just have tons of them.
And they're all paying you simultaneously.
Yeah. And so individually, maybe you're not super worried about what Joe thinks, but you know, if 2,000 of Joe get upset about something, like, it's a problem.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And even some people even think, like, oh, if one Joe complains, that's enough, that's 1,000 Joes behind the scenes.
Yeah, how many aren't complaining?
Yeah.
But the other
how
thing
many
is...
just left or whatever?
Like, expand that even to, like, support. Every Joe or Sarah or anybody who complains or who has an issue, has a problem, anything that's gone wrong, you now need to deal with that, but you need to deal with it on their level. And so maybe that's going out to a support team, so that's not talking about developers anymore, but a lot of that makes its way back to developers anyways.
Yeah.
You know,
we need to rename this thing because no one knows what it is.
Sure.
We need to read. We need to refigure. We need to change these validation messages because no one knows what they mean.
Yeah. So a lot of being a developer is just getting into the mindsets of other people.
Yeah.
Trying to figure out, like, what do our users actually want? What does our client actually want? Is my project manager, when they ask for this, knowing the things that I know and they don't, are they actually asking for this outcome, or are they asking literally for what they said? You need to think about the whys often as much as you're thinking about the what or the how.
Well, that goes to, like, my first story about the forums, where it was like, oh, someone wanted a file input.
Yeah.
Like, that's one of the things that I tell sometimes when I'm working with designers and they hear a client ask for a feature and, like, everyone gets upset, is like, what they think a form is and what we think a form is are way different.
Yeah.
Like, most of the time. We may be aligned, but very rarely.
Yeah.
They think a form is 7 inputs. We think it's 2 or 1. Or, like, you know, it might be, like, they want a form, but they really want, like, a survey. Like, there's weird things where someone's like, I need them to fill out a form. And it ends up being their version of a form, which is... I think it's, like, the jargon thing.
Yeah.
Of, like, the uncertainty around, like... They're saying, they're using the words that I know mean something different.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so what do I need to basically have a client translator all the time to be like, okay, they said form. Do they mean survey? Do they mean actual form? Do they mean, like, they want to print something? Because you can print a form too.
Yeah.
Like, what do they actually mean?
Or do they just want an outcome here? They just want a sale to be made and they don't care at all about the form. That's just in their mental model of this. Like, of course you have to fill out the form first, but maybe you don't.
Yeah.
Maybe you click a button and it just happens.
Well, I like using Craigslist as a site that has the simplest implementation of an account, which is, like, how do you make an account on Craigslist? You create a post, you get an email, and that email contains all the links you need to manage your quote unquote account. You never actually create an account on the site. You don't have to.
Yeah.
Craigslist removed the barrier of having an account to use their service.
Yeah.
Which I think people don't think about enough, but I think it's actually pretty impressive
how
they've been able to, like, you can be a user of Craigslist and never sign up.
Yeah.
Which is kind of impressive and kind of crazy that you can do that.
Well, think about how far you can get in something like Amazon without creating an account. You can get all the way up to pretty much paying for it. You know?
But I think if you use PayPal, I don't even know if you can. I think there's, like, ways around... creating an account, right? Or do you have to create an account for that?
Maybe you don't anymore. I don't know. I have an account.
Because I know that I've done things where it's like, hook up your credit card or, like, pay with PayPal. I'm like, just click pay with PayPal because I got some money in there.
Yeah. Like, well, yeah. Whenever I see a one-off site, like, I want to buy this person's course or something, and all they sell on that site is that one course, I'm not creating an account if I don't have to. Like, why would I do that? That's stupid. But... you know, like the client or someone who maybe that's what they're used to. Like, of course you have to create an account. Like, you have to create an account to buy something. How else would you buy something? It's like, well, no, when they say form, what they actually meant was I want to make a sale or I want to do this.
Yeah. Or, like, I just want to record that someone was here.
Yeah.
Maybe they just want, like, they want the digital version of a guest book. Mm-hmm. Like, there's weird stuff where it's like, I've heard the phrase, like, I want to do this or, like, I need this thing. And, like, what they want and what they need aren't always the same.
Yeah.
And, like, what they're asking for and what you're giving them need to be aligned first before just deciding. I think it's, like, the danger of assumption. I think that kind of goes hand in hand with uncertainty, is, like, uncertainty and assumption, they're probably the same thing because you're uncertain to assume.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you going to do? I think another thing is, like...
you can't make an assumption without uncertainty.
Yeah.
Generally.
Like, or reduce the uncertainty and then make the assumption.
Yeah.
Somehow they kind of go hand in hand. But I think, like, the whole thing of, like, all this stuff is, like, there's always uncertainty. And, like, I was even thinking about, when you said uncertainty, I was even thinking about things, or, like, people change their minds, or, like, the humans, like, the human factor of, like, the human, you don't know what they're going to do next week. And, like, I was thinking about even just trying to keep people, like, and I feel it right now as we're talking, like, trying to stay on track. Mm-hmm. With, like, if we were in a meeting and we're like, hey, we're going to talk about the contact form today.
Yeah.
Then someone comes along, it's like, it's probably hard to read. The website's, like, hard to read because the font's so small.
Have you seen this other person's website? Let's look at that for a second.
Yeah, and you're like, whoa. We're just trying to, like, 5 minutes all later. All we want to do is, like, focus on these three boxes at the bottom of the last page on the site. Let's just point our energy here. And then someone says, like, oh, it's, I'm not a fan of the design.
Yeah.
Like, I guess, like, we'll write a note on that, but, like, we really need to focus on this. And then all of a sudden you're talking about, like, how it works on mobile and, like, oh, it doesn't have a good message, or, like, why does it have to refresh the page to, like, tell me it's submitted? Like, all I want to do is talk about, like, you know, this specific piece. And then all of a sudden we're kind of talking about these, like, somewhat related, maybe not related items. And, like, even like focusing people's attention on, like, the most immediate problem is really difficult. The challenge is, like, you want that focus, but you also want the ability to think abstractly, or think or the sympathy to the other users or other people experiencing the site. You want both.
Yep.
But you don't want them both at the same time. So what are you supposed to do? Like, how do you rectify that? Because you want both, but you can't have both. It's like the specialist, not specialist problem.
Exactly.
Are you a specialist or are you not? Because if you're not a specialist, I don't want you. If you are a specialist, cool, but you can only work in this narrow domain.
Yeah.
What? Something's got to give.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Just dealing with people at all.
Wait for the AI to come. Yeah, AI client manager.
Wait for them to just replace us, and then we can all just the sit long at sleep. Home and watch Netflix.
Yeah.
So I think that's the list there. I mean, I'm sure we could add a million things to this list if we wanted to.
Probably update it every month.
Yeah. What's frustrating me today? Maybe that'll be a recurring thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that's a really solid list. I'm actually glad that you came up with things that were more specific, because some of mine are pretty abstract.
I was happy with the difference. I was thinking, like, oh, maybe we'll hit, like, two or three that are the same, but, like, we weren't even close.
No, I was thinking there, like, of course he's going to talk about, like, dealing with people as a developer.
Yeah.
But again, like, that just goes to show, like, you never know what you're going to get, I guess. With people in general and the different contexts that people have.
I think the funny thing is we talked about doing this a couple times, particular game or whatever, or like,
writing a list of five things each and not telling the other person what's on the list.
And saying, like, oh, they're hard things. Like, think about something that's really hard about development and write down.
Yeah.
And, like, it's funny that we came up with pretty different things and we both agreed to, like, all of the items on the list. Like, yep, that's really challenging. Yep, that's also very challenging.
Yep.
I encountered that yesterday. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you're a new developer and you're listening to the list, be afraid, be very afraid.
Yeah. Hug your mother, kiss your father.
Hug your mother, yeah. but really, as much as we have, we've talked about these and complained about them, and I think that there's a lot of ways to deal with these things, and we're still figuring some of them out. But I think that it's not hopeless.
No, the nice thing is that there's a lot of tools out there that'll point you in the right direction. And there's, like you said, like, right off the top, you were saying, like, there's so many resources that it is hard to make an uninformed decision. If you're making uninformed decisions about in this industry, you're probably on the cutting edge of something new.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you know, nothing's new.
Or you're, like, pushing yourself. You know, you're challenging yourself and you're getting better, which is pretty much always worthwhile.
Breaking new ground on something.
Yeah, exactly. So I think talking about some of these things, you know, why development is hard in general, it it's a good way to get into the podcast in general here, I think. A lot of what we're going to be talking about is going to be related to things like this. If you don't have problems, there's not a lot to talk about usually. We would all just say, hey, everything's great. See you next week.
There's an adage about, like, happiness isn't funny.
Mm-hmm.
Happiness isn't entertaining. Seeing a bunch of people be really happy and, like, really successful, like, that gets pretty, like, oh, I guess it's, oh, great. They're doing well. That's cool. But when something's horrible, you're like, oh, boy, I can't wait to talk about this. Or know, learn more about it or try to mitigate it.
Yeah. If nothing ever went wrong, you wouldn't be listening to us right now.
Yeah. I envy your perfect life, listener.
Yeah. So I think that's probably a good point to leave off at. Anything else that you want to go over here, James?
Nope, I'm good. I'll sleep with nightmares. 5 new nightmares tonight.
Me too. Yeah. All right. Sounds good. Till next time.